It is November 2nd, 2011, and I'm talking to Rex Klontz at his residence. I am Joseph Morris, representing the Linda McKnight Batman Oral History Project for the Historical Society of Central Florida. Mr. Klontz, could you tell us a little about your life?
Well, I was born in 1949 in the hospital, in Orange Memorial Hospital in Orlando, to Rex Klontz Sr., my dad, and my mother Thelma Lee Klontz. I'm going to talk a little bit about their life, if that's okay.
Perfectly, sir.
My dad came to Oviedo riding in the lap of his mother. He was one year old, age of one, in a Model A Ford from North Georgia. In 1937, I believe, my mother was born here on Lake Charm in Oviedo. They both passed on, my mother recently, but so basically both lifelong residents of Oviedo. And after the war they married, and I'm the oldest of their five children. Four of us still live right here in Seminole County, and have one sister who lives in Cartersville, Georgia.
What kind of jobs did your parents do while they lived in Oviedo, sir?
Their families were in agriculture, let me start back just a little bit. My mother's family had her grandfather had moved down here in the 1880s, and her father, my grandfather, C.S. Lee, was born here on Lake Charm in Oviedo. And his dad was in agriculture, take care of citrus trees. And so my grandfather was always in the citrus, vegetable, and cattle business. And so my mother was familiar with all of those endeavors coming up, and it was natural that she married a farmer, my father. His father also had begun farming shortly after arriving in Oviedo.
Same type of farming, sir?
Both of them were vegetable farmers growing celery.
Okay, sir.
They grew some other crops from time to time, but specialized in celery farming. And so, growing up here, that's what my family did. And we had some orange groves, but the majority of the family focus was on the vegetable farming operation. C.R. Klontz and Associated Growers was the company that my grandfather started in the early 1940s, and at one time we farmed over 200 acres of celery right here in eastern Seminole County, Oviedo area. You got a mosquito in your cheek. Got it.
Thank you, sir.
And celery farming was extremely profitable, lucrative during the early 30s and 40s, and was sort of the heyday of the Oviedo celery industry. So their timing was good, and but over but after the war, when all the boys came home from the war, and a lot more celery was being grown in the United States. Markets went down, prices went down. The small farms here in Oviedo weren't weren't as easy to operate, weren't as efficient, and so my father and grandfather purchased land in Zellwood, in the Zellwood Muck area along Lake Apopka, and they did that in anticipation of needing to be have a more modern, large contiguous farm, and so they purchased that in the year I was born, in 1949. And so when I grew up, we were farming both places. My father was farming both multiple small farms here around Oviedo, Black Hammock, Mitchell Hammock, the Slavia area, and we were raising vegetables in at our Zellwood farm, and that was a 650 acres. And as a child, I remember going over, and every year they would clear up another portion of that farm. So they started by farming just 40 acres, and then over about another 10 or 12 years, they cleared the rest of it so that they could farm all 650 acres over there. When I went off to college, I specifically I went to school so that I wouldn't be a farmer. I could have stayed home and been a farmer. So I was planning on working in the business world, and just before I graduated, realized that the business, the one business that I could control, was coming back here and taking over the family farm. And so I came back and joined actively working full-time in 1971 when I got out of college. And I moved over to Apopka and ran that Zellwood farm. We grew celery, lettuce, carrots, sweet corn, occasionally onions and parsley, several crops over the years, but the staple was always celery, sweet corn, and carrots. And in about 1978, we closed down our last Oviedo farm. Up until that time, we'd been farming both places. But we closed that down, and the last farmland that we were actively farming is now is in Mitchell Hammock, is now sod farm along Mitchell Hammock, and between Mitchell Hammock and Chapman Roads. So no longer used for vegetables. Family still owns the land, but we don't farm vegetables on that anymore.
Okay, sir. So your family was no longer in the farming business, but they were in the farming business up until 1978?
Well, we still were in business here in several ways. We always had orange groves here.
Okay, sir.
And we have cattle ranches.
There's my follow-up questions.
Yeah. You know, you'd find most people that have been multi-generational in the vegetable business in Central Florida also have had orange groves and cattle, because the three just naturally go together here. Mm-hmm. And you can, if you're successful in one, you're able to be successful in the other usually.
How come they go together like that, sir?
Well, vegetables are very seasonal. So, you know, you've got a fall crop and a spring crop, but you've got time on your hands during other portions of the year. So, orange grove tends to be more year-round work, but is not as intensive as vegetable farming, so you can sort of work the two together. And then if you've been successful in the vegetable business, you reinvest in land, and very often the best use for that land is cattle. Only certain types of land are good vegetable land, but cattle you can graze just about anywhere in Central Florida.
Okay, sir. Could you give us a little insight into how you grow the vegetables, celery in particular, or citrus in particular, like the methods of how you would go about it?
Celery's in nature, celery grows stop it just
sure thing, sir. Okay, sir. Would you like to continue?
Yeah. Celery in Central Florida is the seed is planted in the fall, and it's planted in seed beds so that you can grow a large number of plants in a small controlled area. You can herbicide them, you can control the irrigation, and as those seeds, because celery seed is a very difficult seed to sprout, it's not much larger than a large flake of pepper, and it takes a long time to germinate, to get any substantial size, and so we would start planting seed in August, but because that seed is so tender, we would oftentimes cover those plants. First of all, lay burlap out as soon as you roll the seed down out on the ground, and let the seed actually germinate under the burlap where it would be cooler and moister. You kept the ground moist with subsurface irrigation and actually surface irrigation between the beds to keep that environment just right for those little seeds to germinate. And then you would remove the sacks after the seeds germinated and started to show the first cotyledon leaves. And we would grow them in a seed bed for about 4 months, and then we would transplant those plants, pull them up by the root, knock the majority of the dirt off the root, and pack them in boxes, take it to the production field, and you would we used a New Holland transplanter, which is a fairly simple machine that is pulled through the field, opens up a furrow, and it has a wheel with a set of fingers on it, and you can put the plants one at a time in the notches in the wheel, and as it goes around and puts the root in that furrow, it releases that plant. And we would have a bank of six of these wheels on the back of a tractor-drawn machine, and go through the field and transplant. We called it setting the celery plants in the field. And from that point, they got immediately irrigated with overhead irrigation, so that the ground got packed good around the roots, and they got a good start. And then it took anywhere from 75 to 90, and if the weather was cold, maybe 100 days to produce that crop. So growing celery is 4 months in the seed bed and 3 months in the field. It's a long cycle, especially when you consider that in the off time you're having someone, usually we got our seed from an arid region like Utah or California, had our seed grown. So between the production of seed and the planting of seed and the growing of the crop was just about a year-round endeavor. And we did all our harvesting in March, April, May, and June.
Why did you transplant it from the seedbed to the production yard? What was the difference between the, is it soil?
No, well, yes, it did happen to be different soil, but you could take 10 acres of seed beds and grow enough plants for 200 acres of field production. And so it was much less expensive to take care of that, to do the fungicide and the weeding and keeping the insects off of it on 10 acres. And then when you pull those plants and spread them out where they would get to a large stalk, planted them at the right distance apart, you could have 200 acres of celery out of that, and you only had 3 months to take care of that 200 acres.
Oh, okay, sir. So it was easier to guard and protect them when they're younger that way.
Much easier, much less expensive to protect them. The transplanting operation was expensive, but it was not nearly as expensive as it would have been trying to put those seeds directly into the field and take care of them for the whole 7 months that it took to grow that. And you could also, when that the seed beds at 10 acres that
excuse trying to
that seed beds
oh, he's
is
gone.
On
no, he's just scouting you out, sir.
The 10 acres that seed beds are on is very, you intensely farm that. And one of the preparations of doing that intense farming, this will keep the mosquitoes out, is that you level that land meticulously. You you ran a very intricate irrigation system, all tile drained, and you used your seed bed land was your most prized possession in the celery business. That seed bed, a good seed bed plot that was the right consistency of soil and the right ability to not only hold moisture, but to get rid of moisture when you had too much rain, to get rid of excessive rainfall, was very important. So celery farmers did a lot of work to try to get their seed bed just perfect and have the right plot of land to do that with.
So that was pretty common then between celery farmers?
Yeah, every celery farmer in the state had their own seed beds, and now seed most celery seed, or a good portion of it, is grown in greenhouses. It's grown in plant trays, in the trays of plants in greenhouses. So it's got much more of a controlled environment to grow in now than when we were growing them outside. But still, the best plants are the ones grown outdoors. Just a lot tougher, a lot more work.
Okay, so did you ever bleach the plants, whiten them?
That was a practice that was kind of came to an end in the mid-1940s. Until then, yes, they took the boards and put down the sides of celery, at least a portion of it, and they would bleach it. And I remember that being done as a child. I shouldn't say that. I remember them talking about it, but I don't actually remember seeing it.
Okay, so, but why would they? Why did they do that? I personally don't understand.
It was a practice that I don't know this for sure, but I think that it allowed celery to be harvested and stored in root cellars and carried much longer through the year than if celery were left green and packed away and stored. A lot of the original celery growers were upstate New York and Michigan. In the north, when they grew celery, they grew it in the late summer, harvested it and stored it, and shipped it out little by little during the wintertime. And so people would traditionally take celery, put it in a root cellar back before refrigeration, and it was very important to try to preserve that as long as you could before, so that you had vegetables and you stored potatoes and everything that you harvested in the fall, you stored and ate on it as long as you could. We're not used to that nowadays. Nowadays you go to supermarket and they've got just about every vegetable year round, but that's just happened in my lifetime. Prior to that, and prior to refrigeration in the early part of the 1900s, vegetables were very seasonal, and so you had an abundance at harvest time. You tried to store that as long as you could, and bleached celery would store better than green celery.
Okay. So
that's the reason. That's the long-winded explanation for bleaching. And because it traditionally had been bleached, even after refrigeration came along in the early part of the 1900s, celery was, had always, people were used to eating bleached celery, so that's the way it was done. That was phased out, and my understanding is that the military, right before World War II, came out with a report that said green celery was better for you than bleached celery, was more nutritious. And that one report was sort of the tipping point. They had been, up until then, for the few years before that, they'd been growing both bleached and unbleached celery. And after that, bleached celery became a thing of the past.
Okay. Well, thank you, sir.
All right, that's a long-winded explanation. It's kind of like, why did all citrus juice come from a frozen concentrate can a few years ago, and now it's available in a in a not from concentrate carton in the refrigerated store now in the refrigerated section of the store, and it's sort of the same thing. It's an evolution of technology and what people are used to, and people don't change their habits overnight. It takes a while.
I got you, sir.
But all the celery starting in the late 40s then was not bleached celery.
So I'm assuming, well, you didn't grow it that way, but your father and grandfather
had bleached it. Definitely did, yes.
Okay. You said earlier that one of the stories you remember hearing them talk about bleaching the celery. Do you remember any other childhood memories pop to mind? You know, whether it's in agriculture or just at school?
Well, when I was... I do remember my grandfather's mules. He obviously started, mules were used a lot in the, exclusively in the 1800s and quite a bit in the early 1900s, because in Oviedo, most of this celery farming was grown on muck, and that soft organic land, the heavy tractors of the day wouldn't stand up. They'd do fine out here on the sand land or where they were mostly used in the Midwest, but that muck soil was, you had to have good flotation, and they would even take the mule's hooves and wrap them in sacks and tie around the hooves to increase the footprint of the mule so that he wouldn't bog up as much when he went through the field. And then at the end of the day, untie those sacks off the bottom of the mule's feet to, and the next day, if it was still wet and soft out there, then retie him, and that would keep him from bogging up. He'd only sink 3 inches instead of sinking 8 inches.
And the mule accepted this.
The mules accepted it, and you know, back then, I mean, if you were going to be a farmer, you had to be able to have a good. You had to know your mules and be able to train them and be able to work them, and it was an art to have a good team of mules. So I remember as a kid, the conversation between my dad and my grandfather, where my dad was saying, "What in the world are you doing keeping those mules? We don't, you know, you haven't plowed a field with them in 5 years now, and we're not going to ever use mules again. I don't know why you're fooling with them." And my grandfather saying, "They're my mules. I can't just get rid of them. I can't, you know, so as long until those mules died, which was probably, I was probably 6 or 7 years old, he still had a barn right on the end of Lake Charm at Florida Avenue, along Florida Avenue there. He had a barn with two mules in it. And but I never saw him work the field. Now, I've seen pictures. I've got pictures of, in fact, I've got pictures of my grandfather with his mule team and his first tractor in the field, and he's smiling. I think he's more proud of the mules than he is the tractor.
He had two mules? Is that like a normal amount? Or?
Well, they generally used a mule team. They generally used two mule teams farming here. And now, I have no idea how many total teams he had, but probably, you know, two or three teams of two.
You said your grandfather had worked the fields. Did your father work also as a farmer?
Yes, yeah.
And growing up, did you do the same?
Well, I worked summers, you know, but so when school got out in the summer, I'd go to work with Dad and work all summer long at the farm. But my dad always... told me that, you know, he wanted me to be whatever I wanted to be. He didn't expect me to come back to the farm. If I did, it was going to be my decision. He wanted me to make that decision on my own.
Okay.
So as I said, when I went off to college, I went so I wouldn't be a farmer, but ended up coming back.
When you came back, sir, did you work mostly the administrative, or did you actually go back and also work the fields as well?
No, I worked the fields. I mean, times had changed, but we had a crew of tractor drivers, but I was the farm manager. I oversaw not only decisions on what we were going to plant and where we were going to plant it, but when the planting times were going to be, and how we were going to try to space the crop out, and what personnel we needed for packing and shipping and selling.
Okay, sir. Can you tell us how it's changed over the years, like Oviedo and the areas you've lived in? Since you were growing up, I'm assuming there's been a lot of changes between then and now.
Well, Oviedo in the 1950s was an agricultural economy. Between the citrus and the vegetables that were grown, the basis for all the economy and all the services here was built around agriculture. That started changing in the late 50s as some of the new equipment that was available had opened up new farming areas in the United States and competition. For instance, in South Florida, the Belgrade area opened up, and it was more economical in a lot of ways to grow products down there than it was up here. These farms tended to fall on harder times, and the more marginal farms and marginal farmers dropped out. Sometimes bought up by other farmers, and sometimes that land was just taken out of production, never to be put in. There's lots of small muck pockets here in Oviedo that I remember having vegetables in them that have not been farmed in 30 years now.
That started occurring in the 50s, you said?
Well, late 50s. And two things happened about the time I started to go to, I graduated from high school and left to go to college. One is Disney opened up, and the other is that UCF was established in our backyard here. And Disney really was the beginning of Orlando being a tourist destination. It had been a wintertime destination for 100 years almost, but it had not been a year-round tourist destination until Disney established Disney World here. UCF being so close to Oviedo changed Oviedo in that it brought in not only the teachers, professors, but all of the services that a large university requires, and of course the students, and so it makes Oviedo a little bit more of a bedroom community to a to that college. Doesn't make Oviedo's not the classic college town, but it is definitely a bedroom community to UCF. My perspective, because I left for college and then didn't come back to Oviedo, I lived in Apopka after that to run that farm, and just moved back fairly recently. I lived in Apopka for 35 years, but had lots of interest here. My family was here, so I was, monthly I was in Oviedo. And so I could see Oviedo change without being part of that change, sort of being distanced from that change. And not easily described, but a very constant growing and getting less and less dependent on agriculture, the more and more dependent on the high-tech industries and moderate, medium manufacturing, light manufacturing, and of course tourism.
As a farmer, did you see UCF and Disney World as problematic for your business or for your community in Orlando?
No. You don't try to rail against progress. It is, and you adapt to it. And our family's operation adapted as needed to those, and one reason why we closed the Oviedo Farms down and just concentrated on our Zellwood operation was because that was the more modern farm of the last part of the 20th century, and the Oviedo Farm was the farm of the first half of the 20th century.
Okay, sir. And you said, since both farms have been closed down, correct, sir?
Yes, we sold our Zellwood farm to the state of Florida as part of a restoration project to clean up Lake Apopka.
And that was 1979?
No, we shut that down and sold that in 1998.
Okay, sir. And have you been working elsewhere since then, or
traveling?
Yeah,
we had citrus groves, and we expanded those after the after selling out the vegetable operation. But basically, downsized. I said I retired when I sold the vegetable operation because I work so much less now than I did back then, but I still stay busy and enjoy growing oranges. And even the citrus business has evolved. When I was on the outside, I didn't think the citrus business changed very much in my whole lifetime. And then once I got involved in it, I realized it is evolving, and so it's an interesting business to be in, and I really enjoy it.
How has it evolved?
Well, we were once again, especially around Oviedo, there were lots of small orange groves. You could send a man on a tractor down the road. If your barn was right here, you could send a man to out on over to Castleberry or up to Lake Mary on a tractor pulling an implement. have him do work there that day and drive back in the evening to do work on a 10-acre grove. Now the liability exposure of putting a tractor on the road, you wouldn't do to, you know, you couldn't make enough money on a 10-acre grove to just cover the liability exposure. So groves now tend to be large blocks of 100 acres, 75 to 500 acres. Anything less than that is pretty hard to caretake. Irrigation systems. Groves weren't irrigated except by portable aluminum pipe that in real dry times in the spring you would hook portable irrigation pipe to a pump and irrigate down that row and for 2 or 3 hours, and you would shut the pump down, move that pipe through the grove, and reassemble it and water another strip. And then now everything is microjet, where there's a sprinkler under every row, under every tree, year-round, a permanent micro-sprinkler, and the irrigation's mostly done by a timer and moisture sensors in the ground so that you don't, nothing's ever touched once it's installed out there.
Okay. Because all I ever see are the orange trees, sir, so I don't get to see underneath the ground. I didn't know what changes had occurred.
They've all got a sprinkler underneath them now.
Okay.
And we're planting much closer than we used to. Trees used to be planted on a 25 by 25 spacing, 25 feet by 25 feet spacing. Now generally planted on about a 12 by 24 spacing, so there's a lot more trees to the acre, and everything's worked one way down a row instead of two ways like they used to do it in a grove. Used to be able to drive down two ways. It's starting to rain. Do you believe that?
No.
Did you leave your windows down?
No, sir.
Okay.
No, it must be that one random cloud right there. It's the one catch about four. You never know when it's going to rain, even with the sunny skies.
I'm so surprised at that. I wouldn't have thought it was going to rain today, as cool as it was this morning.
On the plus side, it doesn't snow randomly.
Not very often.
I think I've seen it snow in Florida one time.
Yeah.
But the snow disappeared before it hit the ground. And that was in the late 80s?
Yeah.
Have you ever seen it snow in Florida, sir? Or?
Yeah, about three different times I've seen where snow stayed around.
Really?
Yeah, but not, the Christmas freeze of 1983, snow stayed in shady spots for 2 days.
Wow. Would not have expected that from Florida. You said you still have the citrus industry, that's the business. Do you still do cattle, or?
Well, the Klontz family never was in the cattle business, but we own pasture land.
Oh, okay.
And so we've never been involved in directly in the cattle business, but we know it well because we've always had land that we leased to my cousins and to other cattlemen who ran the cows, kept up the fences, and paid their lease on that. So it was a way of having a ranch that was active cow ranch without having to be hands-on day-to-day in the business.
Okay, sir. I'm assuming that made it a lot easier then?
Oh, yeah. You're just a landowner. In the cow business, we've just been a landowner, and landlord to the cattleman.
Okay, sir.
And my mother's brother, Robert Lee, was very involved in the cattle business all his life, and so they leased most of our land.
Okay, sir. The jumping off subject. You mentioned you went to college. You were old enough to go to UCF, were you not, or was UCF?
I could have gone to UCF, and instead I chose to go to the University of South Florida down in Tampa.
Oh, really? I didn't even realize that university was that old.
Yep.
So you're a Bulls fan then?
That's
so,
right.
Well, my best friends would love to hear that. I, however, went to Florida State.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's another good school.
It's a good school. It's a... Are there any particular historical events that come to mind when you think over the course of your life, sir, that stick out?
Thinking back into my childhood, I remember one that was, and I don't remember what the year was, probably was about 1961 or 62, a jet aircraft flying a training mission out of what was then Sanford Naval Training Center crashed just a few hundred feet from the edge of what is now Lawton Elementary School, but it was the Oviedo High School, which had all 12 grades at that time. Being in class and hearing that crash and all the flames and all the confusion afterwards, the pilot died in that crash, and one of those things that you'll kind of never forget. But I have forgotten the year, so I guess I do forget it.
But you remember the event, though, right?
I remember the event.
What grade were you in at that time?
It seems like I was in about 7th or 8th grade, something like that. Maybe I was younger than that. Because memory's still pretty fuzzy, but still it was, I remember the confusion of the day.
And was it over by the next day? You were able to return to classes normally? Or?
Oh, yeah. It was the talk of the town for months and months, but it was things got back to normal fairly quickly. Military jets at that time were still, it was the new technology. It wasn't, we heard jets flying, but, you didn't see that many jets back then.
Unless they crash right
next to school. Unless they crash next to your school.
And it's hard to miss them. What kind of relationship did the community have with the military, the base right there? Especially farmers are there.
I think it was a good relationship. Florida was a lot of people who were in the military during World War II, when they got out, ended up coming back to Florida because Florida had been such a good place for military bases in the 40s. It's got the climate where you can train year round. It's a whole lot better being a stationed on a base in Pensacola than it is in upstate Michigan in the wintertime. so Florida had lots and lots of bases that trained soldiers of all types in the 1940s, and as I said, a lot of those people got a taste of Florida, and once they were out of the military and maybe got married and, you know, said, I know where I want to go, and they moved back to Florida.
Can't blame them.
No. It's been happening ever since.
Yeah, sir. Yeah. It's still, I think it's still known for a lot of its military bases being more preferable to work and train here. So you have some in Jacksonville, some down still in Tampa.
Sure.
Yeah. Is there anything we haven't covered, discussed today, sir, that you want to make sure we got to?
No, I didn't have any agenda, and I don't think I've done a very good interview. I think I've done a pretty average job at this. I remember when fire ants were first had first gotten into Texas, and because fire ants are not native to Florida, and so fire ants in the mid-60s were getting into the state from the coastal states, but they had originally come in Texas and then spread from there. And the DC-3 airplanes would fly on ant bait over the whole state. They would take a grid of 8 miles by 8 miles, and they would systematically fly at about 300 or 400 feet high, dropping ant bait on 100% of the ground surface.
Ant bait was?
Well, the ant bait was to try to kill fire ants that were coming to the state. Obviously was not successful.
Obviously. I didn't even know they weren't native to Florida. I just kind of figured they were native everywhere.
No. they seem like it now.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's something that I don't think you'd see happen today. I mean, there's new pests now coming to the state of Florida at the rate of 2 or 3 a year. And, you know, we got pythons in the Everglades. The idea of trying to eradicate an insect like that once it's gotten established in the state is probably never going to happen again.
Probably not, sir. Did that cause any kind of panic or worry with the farmers? But then, if they took it seriously enough to be spraying the entire state to try to get out fire ants?
Well, fire ants are a pest, but we've just learned to live with them. I mean, fire ants can kill a newborn calf. If that calf gets born in the field and the mother cow drops that calf in an ant pile, I mean, fire ants cause damage to livestock right now. They can kill a newborn calf, but there's not a high rate of mortality because of it, and so it's not something that we try to eradicate anymore. But there was a time when there was a very organized war on fire ants.
Who organized this war?
Well, it was at the request of citizens, but it was the government, the ag departments, and so on.
When you say fire ants, you're talking about the red ones. The black ones already been here, correct? Or they both come at the same time?
There's lots of species of native ants here, some of which bite and some of which don't. But the fire ant is the one that, you know, when you step in the mound, you just get swarms of them.
Right.
And
it's one in my front yard.
I take those out every time I see one. I get the ant made out and kill it, but I don't try to eradicate them all over the state.
That'd be a little extreme, wouldn't it? But is there anything else, sir?
No.
All right, sir. This has been invaluable. I really appreciate it. Thank you for letting me come over and talk to you today.
You bet.